Hey folks, I'm Simon Ward, your host for this weekly podcast. Over the years, I've come to realise that achieving one's goals as a triathlete is not possible unless you support this with good nutrition, excellent recovery, develop a robust framework through mobility and strength training, and have a happy, balanced work and family life. Each of these elements contributes to our race day performances and gives us the best chance of turning those dreams into reality. Each week, my goal is to introduce you to the experts and thought leaders in each of these fields to help you squeeze the most from your life and enjoy racing success. So, without further ado, let's crack on with this week's guest. Hi, folks. Well, I am here today with a guest from the other side of the world, from Perth in Australia, Mr. John Foss. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Simon. Good to be on.
Yeah, late in the afternoon for you, early in the morning for me. It's always a challenge trying to coordinate these time zone differences, particularly when you're at opposite sides of the world. So appreciate you making the effort to do that. Thank you.
That's great. It's good to be on.
So John Foss is a triathlete, and we'll get to John's triathlon experiences and exploits a bit later on in the show. But the reason I asked John on is because he is the boss of a company, well, the Cheer Company. And I am really interested in Cheer. On my Facebook pages and, just in social media generally, there's an awful lot of conversation at the moment, John, about sustainability of foods, about food choices. We've had some really good discussions on some Facebook pages about Game Changers, a documentary that you and I were talking about pre-show, and we'll probably cover. But I'm really interested in what you're doing in growing Cheer, and so perhaps you can tell us what your what your mission is, and then we'll go on to how you actually got started in this, because you weren't originally a Cheer farmer.
No, the mission is to make a difference to people's health through plant-based foods, and specifically through Cheer. My background is farming. Our family farmed in Australia for over 100 years, and I was part of that. But I actually was awarded a Nuffield Scholarship in 2001, and the first place I studied was in the UK, and I travelled through Europe and then North America and Asia and on this Nuffield Scholarship, and really studied trends in the food and agricultural industry. And one of the clear trends out of that was that health and wellness, so this was in 2001, but health and wellness was becoming a mega trend. It wasn't just this sort of fad, that more people were caring about how they ate, how they lived. And then that came back to the foods they chose and where, the farming systems that they grew it in. So I was intrigued in that and really started looking for opportunities in the plant-based space, which led me to Cheer back in the early 2000s.
So you spent quite a bit of time trying to identify a niche then, really. It wasn't just something that you stumbled on. There's actually quite a bit of research and effort that went into this.
Yeah, that's it. No, there was a lot of work in and understanding what the trend was, and then it was, well, what are the specific products? And I was really interested. I saw actually a little documentary on Cheer, and it was about a group of Mexicans that lived near the US border that were suffering from Western-style diseases of cholesterol, diabetes, and obesity, and there was a group in that population that weren't suffering the same effects. And the researchers discovered the only thing different in their diets was that they were taking this Cheer Fresque every day, which was a drink of chia seeds with lemon juice and a bit of cayenne pepper. And that was because of the fiber, and it was stabilizing the blood sugars. It was helping to give them satiety, and they just weren't suffering the same effects. So that was enough for me to think there's a bit in, I viewed it cynically, but I thought, well, there's something there. So it led me to research a lot more about the crop, its history, and then obviously the nutrition of it. And I got samples and studied it. And the nutrition stood up that, it was valid, that it was the richest plant-based form of plant-based omega-3, fiber and protein combined.
Just going back to those Mexicans there, have you read the book Born to Run?
Yeah. Those were the groups in the population that were sort of...
Right, and that drink you mentioned there, is that the drink he talks about in there, this sort of little potent mix that they have that they all sit around drinking?
Yeah, I mean, the fascinating story, and this is another whole story about food culture and history, but apparently the Spanish, when they came in there and were sort of taking through that, so the Mexican and some of those parts of Central and South America, they were seeing the locals revere chia as sort of a spiritual product, and they said you can't grow it. And there was only a few little pockets that sort of they kept planting and propagating and growing chia that kept it sort of going in modern culture. So there's a really fascinating story about chia and its history.
You mentioned coming from a farming family. I think reading some of the background before we had this conversation, your family were farming wheat. Is that right?
Yeah. And they still, my brothers have got a large scale wheat farm in Australia. And, you know, part of the challenge for me was looking, sort of having this opportunity to stand back from the farm and going, well, what is the modern food industry? The wheat that we're growing, which we're putting a lot of care and passion into, gets highly transformed and ultimately ending up in a lot of products were unhealthy. And sort of seeing the impacts of that and saying, as a farmer, am I part of this problem of obesity and health related issues from food, or am I the cause or am I the effect? And how do we make a change? So Nuffield Scholarship gave me a great opportunity to sort of look at the world with a lot more, a wider lens, and look at the food industry and then just see that, you know, a lot of people were doing good things inside that industry, but were on this treadmill that was leading us down some bad paths, not for their fault individually, but the whole industry was moving this, you know, pursuit of lower cost foods and greater convenience, and it just forces people to formulate cheaper foods and a lot of them become, you know, lacking nutrients.
How was it received by the rest of your family then when you decided to go off and do your own thing? Are you considered the black sheep, or were you given a pat on the back for your entrepreneurial?
No. High level of scepticism. Mainly, you know, because the guys in wheat had seen that they were growing it and the challenges of that with hundreds of years of research and development behind it. And I've gone and taken on a crop with essentially no research behind it. You know, essentially with the growers where I started working, we had to learn how to grow it, you know, ship it, pack it, clean it, quality. There wasn't standards in the industry. We had to create those standards. And then that was a big enough challenge of growing it and moving it and cleaning it, packing it, processing into a form that people could eat, but then going to food companies and consumers with a product that was virtually unknown. And that was another whole job in educating and creating awareness and getting validity that this was a really healthy, nutrient-dense plant food that people should include in their diets on a daily basis.
So apart from those small pockets of communities where they were producing chia, probably for their own usage and not enough to really export, were you the first people that took to growing chia commercially?
Yeah, there was some little pockets in Central and South America where they sort of developed it up. It was rain-fed production, so there was no irrigation. It was quite variable in the yield and the quality. And then I remember speaking some health food store owners in, you know, Southern California that said they'd had it on the shelves back years ago, but some years they'd get a bit, some years they wouldn't, and it would sit on the shelf and the packs would get dusty. But the biggest challenge, there wasn't a consistent supply, so that the key retailers couldn't put it on the shelf and food manufacturers couldn't include it in products because they couldn't get guaranteed supply. So I was essentially the first to be able to take it into a model that was much more consistent in supply. We could guarantee the quality, the nutrition, and then go to a food manufacturer or a retailer so we can supply it 24/7. You know, we can provide this product to you all year round.
So you chose to grow yours in the Kimberley region of Australia. I've travelled through there, but it was a long time ago now, over 30 years. My recollection was it's red, it's dusty. I don't remember a lot of water, and you talk about needing water there. So what made you choose the Kimberley region?
Yes, so one of the keys in getting the omega-3 level, so, you know, the things that are unique about chia, it's got plant-based omega-3, it's got fibre, both soluble and insoluble, and it's got good protein with the 8 amino acids in it. But the omega-3 is something that's formed in the plant, and it's photoperiod or day length affects the formation of omega-3 oil. So therefore, the day length is affected by latitude. So where it grows in the right latitude is really critical. Mm-hmm. And when I travelled through Central and South America, the best samples I'd identified were on or near 15 degrees from the equator. So I then sort of looked at that latitude in northern Australia and went to 15 south, and it ran through the Kimberley region. And then there's a irrigation system called the Ord Irrigation System, so the Ord River in northern Australia, mm-hmm. and it's this highly sustainable, highly secure water supply. So it had the right latitude, ample water, some really sophisticated farmers actually work there. They're quite pioneering farmers, but also it has this distinct dry season and wet season. So I was able to grow it in the dry season with irrigation underneath it. Because one of the other unique properties of chia is hydrophilic. So when you mix it with water, it turns into a gel. All the puddings you see on the shelves in cafes around the stores of, you know, with coconut milk or almond milk is essentially using that hydrophilic property of chia that when it hits the fluid, it turns into a gel. So that's great. It helps to keep you full and it's good for your gut function. And it's great functionally for foods to extend them and bind them. But it's horrible if you get rain on the crop when it's ripening because it turns into this sort of gluggy gel and ruins the crop. So having this distinct dry season with irrigation underneath was really critical in us being able to produce this really high quality product every year.
Yeah, I actually do remember from being in that northern part of the Kimberleys, when it rains there, it properly rains, doesn't it?
Yeah, no, it's huge. Yeah.
So in that part of the year then, what do you do with your farms? I mean, do they get flooded? Does the land get
They get a lot of rain. So we use what we call sacrificial crops or rotation crops that'll be legumes that will grow that can be either ploughed in or returned so that you get fixing of nitrogen before then the next chia crop or grow some other species, like a grass species, to rotate with chia, which is an all-seed. So we've got this sort of, very sustainable and holistic system of rotating the different crop species around the crop.
I suppose that's one of the things that's often levelled at the sort of plant-based community is that the amount of nutrients that we get in food now is probably not what it was 50 or 100 years ago because the land has been over-farmed. But it just putting through a few processes in my mind there, if the land's getting flooded then or really wet, then that brings nutrients down as the rivers overflow and bring that onto the land. And then if you're growing crops that are not there for commercial basis but really there just to sustain the land with nutrients, you're actually able to keep the soil nutrient density quite high, and I guess that then adds to the value of your product.
Yeah, look, it's a important balance between the microbes in the soil and the carbon in the soil and then the nutrients you have to apply to it. I think it's what we've just learned is it's certainly not a monoculture. It's about rotations, about using other plants in the system. It's about trying to work in harmony with nature as much as possible, using plants that can fix nitrogen, using mulches, using other rotations to get the best or optimize the nutrition in the soil, but also best results to manage either pests or disease that could come into the system.
So all of this irrigation that you have to use during the dry season, are you able to store water from the winter then to sustain the dry part of the
year? This location is very fortunate. It's the most sustainable and secure water supply in Australia. It's only about 2% of the outflow from the river and the dam is used for agriculture, and the other 98% is environmental flow, so it flows through the river system and into the ocean. So it's a really quite unique environment. So it's been great to be able to identify that as a place we could grow chia. It's really been sort of the home of chia in Australia. We've been able to build this industry. We've also grown and do grow in other parts of the world. So we've had projects in Africa and Kenya and Tanzania. We've done some work in Sudan, Nicaragua, Bolivia, Northern Argentina. So we've had a number of different projects around those latitudes in other parts of the world.
So I have a couple of questions on that then. What was the land used for? Where you're using it now and where you're growing it now in Australia, what was that land used for before, or did you have to go and persuade farmers to sell your land so that you could set up your operation?
No, it was quite ironic. I mean, we still work with the farmers that own most of the land. It was sugarcane country. So they were growing sugar and there was issues with sugar as a commodity. It's highly cyclical and the prices go up and down and the growers have very little impact into the end sort of result. And they were looking to sort of move away from commodity crops. And so I came along at a time when they were sort of moving away from sugar and looking for a different crop to grow. So they were very enthusiastic about growing chia with us, which was great.
Oh, well, that's a good impact then, because as we both know, you know, refined sugar is another huge problem around the Western world. So not only have you helped to boost the plant-based community, you've done a little bit to reduce the amount of sugar floating around the world.
Yeah.
So my second question is then, outside of Australia, you mentioned the work you've done in other countries, and often we think of those countries as ones that are economically challenged, if you like. So do you feel like you've been able to sort of make a contribution to the economy and the communities in that place as well?
Yeah, it's been interesting, a little double-edged sword. It's been, you know, we've been quite open with sharing our knowledge and expertise and share to other regions because of the goal in one, getting supply, but also, you know, helping those economies and those communities with better and higher value crops. It's hard to keep it. So, you know, in Australia, we've got a group of growers that are very conscious about the supply and demand balances and the quality and consistency, and they work really closely with us. As we've sort of stretched away, it becomes a little more challenging to maintain that level of sort of consistency with each other. And so there had been, as the, you know, prices in the market were increasing, the growers would grow a lot more than we may have recommended they did at the time, and then that ends up with some oversupply and then prices come down. And so it's just part of the cyclical nature of some of these sort of smaller niche crops. It's quite easy to go from undersupply to oversupply. Mm. And that's something, when you're connected so deeply into the market as we are, we've got a very good handle on what's happening in the demand side. But if you're you know, a grower in Central or South America that doesn't have the same level of connection, then you may get a bit enthusiastic of planting a lot more than the market's actually looking for, and that can create oversupply. So we've been dealing with that over the last decade.
Does Chia have, I mean, I suppose that there'd be certain differences around the world, but does it have, where your main growing is based in Australia then, do you have any pests, and how do you protect the crop from those pests? Because I get that you're really engaged in this whole eco-sustainability, and therefore you'd want to not use chemicals as much as you could possibly avoid, but do you find you have to resort to that at times, or is it a pest-free crop?
Look, it's not pest-free, but it's interesting. It's from the mint family, and it does emit some sort of natural resistance to a lot of the insect pests. So we'll be farming chia in a region where they're growing chickpeas and beans and other sort of legume crops, and they'll be seeing that there's a lot of aphids or caterpillars or other things chewing on the leaves of their crops, and they won't have the same impact on chia, which is amazing. And, you know, we've done some analysis of that leaf matter, and it appears there's some sort of natural you know, inhibitor to the insects, you know, attacking it. So we don't really know what the compound is. We don't know, and there's certainly insects go into it, but they're not to the level that create any issues for us. So we're fortunate we've got a crop that's, you know, minimal impact from insect pests.
Wow, you've found the perfect place for growing that's not too far from where you live. You found the perfect crop that doesn't need pesticides, and there must be some downsides to all of this, John.
Yeah, no, look, it has its challenges. It's a tiny seed. It's, you know, it's challenging to grow. It's challenging to harvest. It's this big prostrate plant that when it gets dry, it'll shed with the wind and stuff, and if it get rain on it at the wrong time, it's a challenge. So it's not easy, but we've certainly looked at how it works best in the environment we've got and in the system we've got to grow to the best we can. And look, we were sort of instrumental in educating the market on what chia is and building that market. We've had a lot of other people come into the market, but I think what we've focused on really clearly is our quality, our consistency, our education process and our credibility in the market, and that's sort of maintained us as a, I would say, as one of the premier suppliers to the, you know, the higher value markets and the major food manufacturers and food companies that really can't compromise on quality and consistency and safety and stable pricing. So that's what we've been out of.
Do you see that the market around the world is growing, and is it growing fast? And are there, is this an even spread across the whole world, or are there certain pockets where you see that you know there's bigger growth than others?
Look, we've seen some areas that'll, you know, really pop. The market will go crazy for a short period of time, and it may be the, you know, result of Oprah Winfrey in the US saying that she thinks she is a good thing, or there'll be a, you know, celebrity share for a celebrity Meghan Markle will say that, you know, on a blog that she eats chia puddings for breakfast or something like that. And you will see this real big spike in demand and consumption for a window. But what we're seeing is a steady increase in all markets, and particularly that demographic of people that care about what they're eating, prepared to pay a little bit more to get, you know, plant-based and nutrient-dense foods. As awareness of what chia is, you know, we've seen that consistently go from a product that was in the health food stores to now being, you know, in the aisles of mainstream supermarkets like Sainsbury, Tesco, Waitrose, all of those stores, as to having, you know, lines of chia in the shelves. And that's really the best indication this is a product that's gone from, you know, the niche to mainstream. And it's now in, you know, finished products like bread, you know, in dairy, yogurt products, it's in baby food, beverages. So it's, you know, really expanding to mainstream food.
You might be in line for an official royal seal of approval then, if Meghan Markle's using your product. Need to get that one from the Queen or Prince Charles. I mean, Prince Charles is fully engaged in this whole sustainability thing with his farms in the UK. Have you had any communication with him or his team?
I haven't. But no, I've read a lot about what he talks about and his philosophy on sustainable food production, and it makes a lot of sense. Yeah,
so. It won't be long. I think he likes coming to Australia.
Well, I was just in the UK last week, so I was with the team there and all around the stores and cafes, and just, you know, amazed at how the plant-based movement is getting so much momentum in the UK. I mean, I travel regularly to the UK, but every time I travel across, just particularly in London, but even, you know, in wider areas, just the menus in restaurants, the offering on the shelves in supermarkets and cafes, you know, plant-based, vegan, so, you know, it's certainly building in momentum. So that's exciting for us as we expand our food offering, you know, with chia in it and beyond chia.
Yeah, often being a success in business isn't because you've got a bad idea or you're bad at managing it. It's about timing, isn't it? And it seems that you've got started with growing, and now as you're getting a good hold on all of those other factors you've described about production and climate, there's a sea change in opinion, certainly from those people who are engaged in the diet, and you're now right in there at the right time as that sort of move towards plant-based or more plant-based eating is taking a real hold.
Yeah, that's definitely, and we're seeing that a lot. That, and our conversation is going a lot more from, you know, 10 years ago is what is chia, and, you know, they'd never heard of it and how would I eat it, to then talking about how can they include chia in their diet and, you know, what's the best way to include it and some of the recipes. And now the conversation is much more around plant-based foods and, you know, talk about other plant-based foods and how they work with each other and how they complement, and if I'm trying to get a bit more protein or fiber or and that's, for me, is a really exciting journey to be on, because it's, you know, I don't see this as a fad that it's just a product that came and go or a trend that's going to come and go. I think this is a movement that has certainly got momentum, and there'll be different levels on the continuum of where people sit in that, you know, whether it's the philosophical argument or whether it's an environmental argument or debate or whether it's a health and wellness and nutrition debate or a combination of all of those. I think, you know, where you sit in that movement, there's just a strong desire for people to see the benefits of having more plants in their diet. And I think that's, you know, a great conversation for us to be a part of. And it's one that we've got some credibility after being in, you know, plant-based and chia for over a decade.
I recorded a podcast with some friends of mine, all of whom are vegetarian or vegan. Jack was his triathlon coach, used to coach the Brownlees and most of the last Olympic team. His partner Kirsten is a yoga teacher, and Louisa's my physio, and she was a professional triathlete. So we had this discussion, and far from being a sort of a whole sales pitch on eating plant-based foods, it was really an educational journey. And what I liked about that conversation was they were all at pains to point out that one of the biggest obstacles to people moving over to plant-based was education. So we all know that if you eat meat and dairy products, you're going to get protein, and there's, you know, the whole range of proteins are available in meat. And one of the biggest problem for people then not eating meat is where are they going to get an adequate and effective supply of that full range of proteins? And before they gave up meat, Louisa was saying that they should educate themselves on what products they could use that would allow them to be plant-based, that would have that supply of protein. Chia is obviously one of them. Quinoa is another one. And there's obviously some other vegetable products and some of the pulses and nuts and beans that you mentioned. But chia could play quite a big part in that for those people who really want to make the move away from eating meat and having adequate protein. Does chia have the full range of amino acids in it, or is it missing?
Yeah. No, it has the 8 amino acids. It's got a good amino acid profile. It's around 20-21% protein, so it's a good balanced protein. I mean, it's not as high as some of the pulses, beans and peas, but it balances that with the omega-3 and a really nice fiber profile. So it's a really it's a really good balanced nutritional profile for chia. The other great thing about it is it does have this functional, this gelling property, and that's where I've got a daughter who's a celiac, and a lot of the replacements for gluten and bread become, there's products that really struggle with texture and, the rheology, the dough's challenge because you don't have gluten is part of the thing that gives that stretchiness, and you take that out and you end up with crumbly, challenged bread or pastry products. So, you put chia in as a replacement for that and it starts to have some impact on taste and texture. So there's some real benefits there. And then we've seen it, the rise of chia puddings, which we pioneered with the chia pod, which was essentially just coconut milk or almond milk with chia seeds, and it makes this little pudding. And that, they've gone from being essentially an unknown product because we actually had to go and get them registered as products around the world and, safe to eat. And now just about every cafe you go into that's, it's got some form of a chia pudding on the shelf. And so, again, it's got a great nutritional profile, but it also gives satiety because it gives a full feeling and a good for the digestive system. So people are eating it for breakfast or snacks through the day. And then I think one of the other barriers to people moving to more plant-based diet has been this reality or perception that taste is compromised. And they've gone, that's great, but I just, I'd love to eat more plant-based or vegan or vegetarian products, but they just don't taste good. And in a lot of cases, that's been, real. But I think the work that's been done by small and large food companies in the last 4 or 5 years to really optimize taste has been groundbreaking. I think now people are saying, well, I'm not having to give up taste because I'm changing to plant-based. So I think that's, that's exciting because there's some really solid work here.
Yeah, I would agree with taste, although I've eaten with Jack and Kirsten and Louisa, and some of the meals that they make are definitely not lacking in taste. And I know one of Kirsten's big thing was cooking should be fun. Unfortunately, in the modern world, we're all so pushed for time that we want convenience. And convenience leads us to buy things off the shelf, which have got lots of stuff that maybe cynically, attract us to that taste and make us want more. But actually, if you set aside some time to cook and you use spices and flavorings, natural spices and flavorings, and you get food products that have got different textures as well. You've got soft, you've got juicy, you've got crunchy. If you know about what your food stuffs are, then you can have all of those textures in a mouthful and you can have those tastes, but it requires a little bit of effort and education. And I think that's part of it as well, is you've got to make a bit of an effort if you want to eat well, and particularly if you're going to change from convenience foods and things that are easy to pick up off the shelf.
Yeah, we've tried to do it. We understand, as a creator and manufacturer of foods as well as chia, we understand, dynamics of busy lives means you don't have a lot of time for that. So we're trying to create more products that, tick the box on convenience as well as nutrient dense and better for you. But we're also about, as a company and myself philosophically trying to promote, a love of food. So rather than spend time talking about calorie counts and what you shouldn't have and what's not in the food, we very much encourage people to think, have a positive relationship with food and really, enjoy it and enjoy what's in it. And if you're eating the right foods, you will be satisfied. And that is a whole different approach to food rather than what's not in it and counting calories and removing.
I do some work as a nutrition coach, which is slightly different from a nutritionist. It's more about helping people to overcome those obstacles and those log jams that stop them eating the right way. And one of the messages that we always have is that I think the population has it backwards, because everybody wants to worry about their weight and calories and how they look. And rather than thinking, well, do I feel better by eating this food? So, is my body working efficiently? Is my digestive system working efficiently? Do I process foods? Am I getting the right sort of energy? How does that mean in terms of having energy through the day, but then being able to sleep at night? Am I free of illness and disease? So do I feel better first? As a result of feeling better, do I perform better? You know, in all ways, not just in athletic pursuits, but do I perform better as a human? Am I able to think clearly? Am I able to think rationally? Do I have mood swings and, energy swings? And then once, if you get the feeling better and the performing better right, by default, you end up looking better by focusing on the nutrients and nutrient-dense foods, as we've talked about, rather than just looking at the calories and thinking about, how many calories you need in a day and how many you're burning. Okay, look, we've talked a lot about sustainability. Do you think chia is a product that's going to save the world from itself? Because there's a lot of talk about how we're overproducing food and we're chopping down the rainforest to create palm oil and, find land for more cows to be reared so we can produce more meat, and that is unsustainable. So if chia grows hugely, is it going to save the world? And are you going to be the man who saves the world?
No, unlikely to. But I think it's to be honest, I see chia playing a part amongst a lot of nutrient dense plant based foods, and all, we've had a diet in the last 50 years been dominated by 4 or 5 plant species. There hasn't been a lot of diversity, and so I think any of these new crops that can come along that we can develop and turn commercial and get from being sort of a little niche into more mainstream consumption, I think is positive. Chia on its own is not going to change the world, but I think it's one of some really good crops and plants that can go towards making a change. And really, by turning it into products and foods that people love and get nutrient-dense meals from, that will encourage more people to eat. And, at a high level, I think the Lancet study that was published last year is a pretty good snapshot of looking at can the issues of the world, environmental issues, and the food system fix itself. And it's pretty basic. It's just saying if we can double plant food consumption and halve animal-based, then that will ultimately lead to a sustainable system of production and consumption of food. And, that's a big change from where we're at the moment, but it's I don't think it's insurmountable over the next few decades. So I see chia as being one of many crops that can be part of that. And I think the chia company and what we're doing, we play an important role of being someone that's a leader and passionate about it and, trying to not only provide the best agronomy and production and crop of chia, but then doing that in turning into ready-to-eat foods and food offering that comes from that. People go, I'll eat more of that. We love that. We love the taste. We like the way we feel after eating that. So, I think it's a big challenge for mankind and humanity to actually get their head around this, but it's actually to break it down and just work on it step by step, I think can really be the answer. So we're excited about being part of that movement. I think it's we're certainly on the same journey. We've got a voice in it. We've got some credibility, and we like to hopefully lead with the products and the offering that we put in front of people, because if we can do that, then that will turn the dial and talk about it and communicate it like we're doing today and like we're doing with a lot of we like to really engage with our consumers and all that audience through how we talk to them and the message we send.
The fact that it has omega-3 in as well, I think, is quite important, because one of the things I've learned as I was studying to be a nutrition coach is that perhaps some of the foods we eat and the way we eat them particularly those that have got high fructose corn syrup, have a bit too much omega-6. And there is supposed to be a balance in the body. I think it's a 1-to-1 or a 2-to-1 in favor of omega-3, but it's actually getting out of sync, and there's too much omega-6 to omega-3. And we need to eat more products that have got omega-3. But if you don't want to eat fish, oily fish, that sort of cuts down some of your options. So again, for those people who want to go plant-based, but also want to get those omega-3s, chia would seem like a fairly good option.
Yeah, it's got great profile, the omega-3 ALA. It's, and this is the omega-3 that's great for cardiovascular health and lean muscle mass and skin and hair. And it does convert it at arguable different rates to EPA, DHA in the body for cognitive health and eye health. But we get less into the debate about which type of omega-3. And so these are complementary, and just, getting plant-based omegas into your diet is really beneficial. And there's some other sources, some other plant-based sources, there's some nuts. But chia is really one of the richest forms of omega-3 oil. So it's a great and it's a great oil. It tastes delicious. You can, we use it to stack it, but we spread it on salads and put in smoothies. And, it's easy to use and it tastes delicious.
Oh, so there's a chia oil as well, and I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah. We cold press it. I mean, it's interesting. We don't sell it as much as we use it, to be honest. It's, the awareness is probably not there for the cold pressed oil, but it's a really beautiful oil. It's not for pan frying. It's a bit too delicate for that, but it's a really good oil. But eating, when you're eating whole seed chia, you're getting 30 to 35% oil in that seed anyway, of which about 60% is omega-3 ALA. So it's a really high profile ALA.
Well, when I look at the seeds, they remind me of a baby brother to quinoa. Is it from the same family at all? Are they connected? Because it seems
not the same family. Yeah, but it's grown in similar regions. Yeah, and it's very complementary. Again, it's like if someone says, should I be eating quinoa or chia? It's like do both. Quinoa is more of a staple. You can eat a bowl of salad with quinoa in it, and you can eat, a full meal. But chia is more of a topper to that. A tablespoonful a day is about enough, really. A couple of tablespoons a day, 16 to 20 grams a day, is enough to get your daily serve of omega-3.
Yeah, I like the little sachets you've got. It goes on my porridge in the morning with my flax seeds, and it goes on my salads. And that's when I was talking about the texture there. It just adds that little bit of crunch to the salad. So I guess that's probably enough for me then, isn't it? Two sachets like that during the day?
Two shots a day, yeah, that's it. Yeah, and that's why we sell it in that form. So that's 16 grams, which is the daily dose to get your daily serve of omega-3. And those little shots have been great, been a great seller, and people just put them in their handbag or their bag for work and just sprinkle on yogurt, sprinkle on salad, sprinkle on in their smoothies. It's been really popular.
I took some with me when I was traveling around America. Then I thought, when you go into America and they have those, the agriculture forms that you fill in, is that something I shouldn't have been taking across border with me?
No, I think it's fine. There's plenty in America.
but I did like that. Just having those sachets with me and just sprinkling it on something in the morning. And we do have a discount code that I'll share with listeners in the show notes, John. So those listeners in the UK, you'll be able to get a discount on products from the chia company. So I'd definitely recommend that you go along and try that stuff. It's a nice addition. And I'm sure if we put them in touch with Anne, who's a triathlete as well. So we're looping around. Sure. We're going to come on to the triathlon story in a moment. I've got a couple more questions to ask you about chia first. John, obviously, if chia is growing, at what point do the big companies like Monsanto and Bayer sit up and take notice? And do you feel that that might be a threat to your business, or is it just not big enough for them?
Look, it's not so much those big ag chem life science companies. There's certainly been interest from some of the big global grain traders that have seen an opportunity to expand beyond their commodity crops. So they are sort of taking a position in some of these ancient grains. Look, for me, it shows that they take it serious. They can see this is not just a little fad that they would pass by, that they need to engage in it. And that's the cycle of, if it's something successful, you're going to get major players coming to it. I think it's, for me, validation that, I was able to identify a crop that has got longevity and has got capacity to go beyond just a fad that was going to be, wrapped around some marketing campaign. It actually genuinely is a highly nutritious product. And for that, and we always used to talk about how long will this sort of curve be? And we're saying, how do we make it a 50-year curve that people are continuing to eat and it becomes a staple in people's lives? So if a major player enters the market, both in production or supply, of course, in a small market, that's going to have an impact. We've been pretty focused on the fact that we need to grow the best and supply it to the best and highest value markets. And if we can do that, then we've got a successful business model. And then we've really pivoted from being a company that started as a grower and sort of a seed supplier wholly to then making our own products and becoming, and more of our business now is a sort of CPG packaged, ready-to-eat food business. And so we're continuing to sort of move in that direction as we grow. So a high percentage of our growth is in the food part of the store and less in the as an ingredient, just to give us that bit of resilience of our business model and diversity in our market. But I look, as again, what I have come to realise over my career in farming and food is that the major companies, they're made up of lots of really good people, and they've got a job to do. They want to do their job well, and those companies can get a bad rap at times. But you break it down and say, well, who's working inside them? A lot of the big food companies have got some great people that want to make a difference, and if they can continue to get have a strong voice inside those companies, then they'll be able to make a change in making good food and sourcing from sustainable supply chains and making a difference to the agriculture where they're sourcing from. And if that can happen in collaboration with smaller, innovative, entrepreneurial type companies, then I think we can make a big difference. But I don't think they're all, big doesn't necessarily equal bad, even though at times they become a major competitor to us as a small company. But when you get and talk to some people that are making decisions inside those companies, they are, majority are there for good, which is just a matter of changing the dial and changing the conversations inside those companies.
In our pre-show discussions, we were talking about a documentary that's been out a few months now called Game Changers. I know you said you hadn't watched it yet, but I've seen it, and I've shared the links to the documentary and asked people to watch it and then engage in a discussion. And what I've been interested in is that a lot of people have said, I'm actually going to stop eating meat as a result of watching this. I mean, there's some confirmation bias in the program. Like a lot of documentaries, you can see going through it that they had an outcome they wanted to get to, and it's almost like they're steering the whole program towards reaching that outcome. I don't think that they were very good in sharing the fact that the producer and his wife own a huge pea protein company, which if they were producing research, they would have to declare as that there was some funding bias. But nevertheless, the fact that people are discussing this openly and thinking about the quality of the meat and how it's farmed and the sustainability and all of that other stuff and looking at products like yours must be huge. Have you been party to any of these discussions that or seen them that people have been talking about where they're actually thinking more about their food and where it comes from?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I remember writing my Nuffield report, and this is in 2001, and it was... the trend will be that consumers are going to want to know more about where their food came from and how it was grown and the impact it's had on the environment, the community it's grown in, and the impact on themselves. And this is, this is fundamentally a trend that's going to take place. And ironically, the first time I ever came to the UK was in February 2001, and I got out of Heathrow and picked up a paper, I think, as I got up to Paddington Station off the train, and foot and mouth had just broken out in the UK. And it basically says, stay out of the country. And here I was to do this scholarship to study food and agriculture, and the UK was my first port of call. And I wasn't allowed to go out into the country. they were trying to, limit the amount of people that travelled around, which ended up being it was a silver lining because I spent a lot more time in London and major cities across the UK talking with retailers and food processors and some of the NGOs that were having an impact on food production and land use in the UK. So it was fascinating. But I think the conversation has really built, and I've seen, in the last few years, that whole momentum about where food's come from, what's in food, impact on the environment particularly, and then impact on communities and impact on people's own health and well-being is, it's gone from being obviously being in the food industry, that's what you talk about, but it's gone to mainstream conversations now. And I think that's great because it's, you know, people, everyone can be an expert, everyone eats, so everyone has can have an opinion on food, you know, that, and for me, it's like someone will say, well, why should they have an opinion because they're not in the industry or they're not a nutritionist, a dietitian, but if they eat, they're very entitled to have an opinion on food. And so, therefore, everyone's starting to get a good voice on it. And I think it's great. And, you know, as I said to you at the start, I hadn't seen the movie yet. I've seen the clip on it. I think one of the fascinating things for me is that it looks like it extols the virtues of plant-based from a performance perspective. And that's probably been one of the things that's been challenged in the past is that, you know, can you perform at your optimum if you're eating a plant-based diet? And clearly, you know, there's a strong theme through that is around, you know, the performance of people, improving their performance because of it. And then obviously there's an environmental conversation that's really active, and then there's a philosophical conversation about, you know, should animals be consumed? You know, and that's, for me, it's not about where I would take a position on any of those other than it's great to have the conversation debate. And if that's raising it up and people talking about it, then that's great because that'll force change in the food industry, force change in the foods that are made, force change in agriculture, how people, and it's a very transparent world now. You know, we travel and work through Central South America and Africa and parts of the world that, you know, what you produce, people can see it. People can, you know, YouTube and videos on cameras means everything's transparent, really. And I think that's a great outcome if that's the way the world evolves.
I think you mentioned earlier on in the conversation about saving the planet. If we could all eat a bit more plant-based nutrition and a bit less meat, that would alter the balance enough to make the world's economy and the world's farming sustainable rather than, as some people would want, completely wipe out animal farming and animal husbandry. You know, I'm thinking about some of the, and probably the same in Australia, some of the communities are entirely based around farming and farming of animals. And if those animals and that animal farming wasn't there, then those communities would be wiped out. So you change one thing but destroy another. So there's got to be some sustainability in those communities. And I think that the rational people here would say, we don't want to eliminate all that. We just want it to be more sustainable. We want to have less waste, and we want to have people be more educated about something that's actually going to save the planet. And farming isn't the only thing that we need to change to save the planet, but it's one of them. And again, you get people saying, well, what can I do on my own? Well, if we all do a little bit, if we all make a small little change, that's a start. Governments have got to get on board with it as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you spend much time? I know that I read that you were a spokesman for the cheer industry. Do you spend much time speaking to people in government as well about general farming practices?
The governments, again, they're struggling with this, and so they want people that are informed, educated, and, you know, relatively rational in the conversation, because it's, you know, they're often people that have come into portfolios or ministries that may or may not have had a background in it, and so they're trying to make the best decisions on behalf of all their constituents, and so they're trying to get a whole, you know, a balanced conversation happening. And I speak regularly at state and federal level and internationally, which I enjoy. But I think it's, as I say, wherever the conversation is, and whether it's an emotive one or a rational one, I think it's good. I think it's good that the conversation's being had rather than just, it happening in isolation. So I think that's how you get change.
Let's move on to triathlon, John. I know you spend your time in... you're in Perth now, aren't you? Based in Perth, your offices.
And
you live in Perth. You've mentioned spending some time in the UK, and I know you spend some time in New York. So that's a lot of traveling. There's a lot of time zone changes to get over. Clearly, you're running an expanding business. How many employees do you have worldwide now?
Directly is 30 odd, but we have a lot of sort of subcontracting and outsourcing, but yeah, we try and keep a fairly tight team. But yeah.
Okay. So when, you know, if you're trying to be a triathlete, where do you find the time to get your training done?
It's interesting. I've changed my, so I was a lot more competitive a bit younger. I did have a few little heart issues from overtraining at one stage, so I had to back it off a bit. I was one of those triathletes that gets a bit addicted to it. And, you know, because you ultimately compete against yourself and your time, it's one of the downsides of triathlon, I guess, is the upside is you'll love it and get so committed to it, but the downside is they can take your life over a bit. So, I then had to sort of pause a fair bit and just rebalance what I was trying to do with triathlon. So I found a rhythm where I start work in West Coast Australia on the same time as East Coast Australia, which is 3 hours different. I used to train in the mornings, but now I get up and ride to work, which is not far, and then work in the morning and have phone calls with the Melbourne office. So if they're starting at sort of 8 a.m., I make sure I'm at work for 5 and sort of get in to 4:35 and have conversations. That crosses over the US, New York office. They're still at work, and it also can cross over the UK. So by doing that, but then I usually train in the middle of the day. So I get out in the middle of the day and do my swim or have a ride or a run, but certainly not quite as competitive and aggressive about my tri competing as I was as a younger guy.
What distances were you competing at then? Because you don't, the listeners don't know that we have the benefit of video here, but so you don't, I couldn't, yeah, I'm not going to try and guess on your age. Maybe you could, if you're happy to share that.
I had 50 last year. So
Well, I wouldn't have put you at 50. That's for sure.
Thanks. Yeah. So okay. Pretty good. And I can cheer every day.
That's yeah, of course. Yeah. Yeah. So, So what sort of triathlons do you sort of?
I was doing short, but I did a lot of, circuit around the Australian sort of country circuit and, you know, a lot of mainly short course. I never did any of the, I was never committed enough to do the, the Olympic series, or never went to Hawaii or any of the cool places where the best of the best go. But I loved it. It was more for fun and competition and, than the competition. And I think one of the great things about it was what I love about tri is just balancing up the legs that you're weaker in and spending some time training and seeing progression in one and the other. And it's one of those things that you can never be perfect at. And I think you're one of the great thrills from it. You can finish a triathlon with 1,000 people in it, but you might have only beat 200 home, but you still can be pumping the air that you've done a PB and you've had a great, great swim leg or a great ride or a great run leg. And I think for me that gives it, it's a sport that then can sort of go on through your age, because you're sort of, you can go and do a great triathlon and go, geez, I've really, for my age group or my for what I set out to do today, I've achieved it. So I think it's a fantastic sport, and I love the way, younger kids are getting into it, but also, you do a lot of triathlons, some really people getting on their years and just loving it, and, it's keeping them fit and motivated.
I spent a bit of time in Perth. I said I'd been to the Kimberley region. I was a bike courier in Perth City Centre for several months during my travels. And, Perth struck me as a great place to be an athlete. It gets a little bit hot in the summer, but the beaches are always nice to swim in, as long as you're sure that you've not got any sharks out there. I know there's been a few well-publicised shark attacks. Just a nice place for running down by the Swan River.
It's great. After living in New York for the last 5 years and before I came back to Perth, where, you got a brutally cold winter and then you got a pretty hot summer, and Manhattan gets really hot in summer because of all the concrete, it just coming here with its, fresh air, beautiful river and oceans to swim in and beautiful bike paths, and the roads are pretty empty. And the pools are all, you can get clean lanes in the pool most days of the week if you want to have a swim or go to the ocean, get, clean water there. So it's a great place for training. And the sun comes up at 5 o'clock in the morning, so you can get a lot in the morning if that's how you train.
Yeah, I remember a lot of jellyfish in that Swan River.
Yeah, you're right.
And, I went windsurfing in the Swan River, fell in. And then as I was swimming back to the surface, I noticed that my path to fresh air and back onto my board was just blocked by just hundreds of jellyfish. It was like swimming in it was like swimming in a jelly, really. It was horrible. I don't remember getting stung by any, but it was, the prospect of swimming way through them and getting on the board. It certainly picked up my technique anyway, because I didn't want to fall in after that. I mean, you've just down the road there in Busselton, you've got one of Australia's top Ironman races. I think it's coming up in a few weeks, haven't you?
Australia. It's hugely attended. It's great event. It's a really flat course, but it can get windy. And that's West Australia gets a strong wind in the afternoons.
It has this Fremantle Doctor.
Yeah. So that's great if you're into kite surfing or windsurfing, but if you're trying to train or ride, particularly in the afternoon, it just blows you around. I have swum the Rottnest Channel Swim a few times. That's from Perth, Gotteso Beach across to Rottnest, which is 22 kilometres. And, it's okay for about half, but if the sea breeze catches you, you feel like you're swimming on the spot for the last half of that one. But, Busselton's a great triathlon.
There's some friends of mine that are based out there actually. The guys from Swim Smooth, have you come across them, Paul Newsom? Another friend of mine, Emma Brunning, she's one of their tutors, so she comes over and teaches all the coaches, and they spend several weeks in Perth. And I know Paul's always talking about doing the Rottnest Swim, and I think Emma's done it as well. It's quite a popular. I think it sells out fairly quickly, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. It's in February next year, and it sells out within a day.
Yeah. Obviously, from our conversation, I'm sure I'm pretty aware that you've got a really good understanding of nutrition. We talked about game changers. You mentioned your heart condition. Do you follow a plant-based diet yourself?
Yeah, and try to eat more plant-based the time.
No meat at all?
No, we still have some meat in the diet. Been moving sort of away from it, I still eat some meat. I think it's been really interesting as I've ate less meat, feel better, being able to substitute that with more plant-based foods. It's been really interesting. Some of our kids have got some, different dietary issues, and just how we've sort of adapted our diets to be more aligned with theirs, so it makes it easier. And, I think the fascinating thing is you just see how your body reacts to changes in your diet. Not only your physical well-being, but as you say, your mental, and whether you're tired or not tired, or whether you're lethargic. And so I just think this is a new frontier, really, in this discovery of how what people eat, not only where it's come from and that, but, what am I eating and how am I eating it and when, and the impact that has on people's overall well-being, particularly the state of mind, mental state.
Jess, one of your colleagues, asked me to write a blog for your website about being a high-performance human. It's this little project that I've got, which sort of goes beyond triathlon. You would be a sort of a person that I would say would fit into this, as in terms of that target market. You want to perform well. Obviously, you had that health issue with your heart, and so that's a concern about making sure that doesn't you manage that. You've got family, and obviously you've got family nutritional concerns that you mentioned. You're trying to run a business and you're traveling a lot. So you're sort of spinning a lot of plates. And I suspect from chatting with you that you're the sort of person who wants to spin those plates well. You don't want to let any of them wobble and drop off and break. And whilst we all get a bit too focused on stuff, we might get a bit too focused on our triathlon at times, or you might get too engaged in business, you get sharp reminders that, hey, you need to focus on this or you need to focus on that. And this whole thing about nutrition, being engaged in your body, about being so in tune with your body that you know when you feel better from foods. And actually, if you eat those foods that you've moved away from, you can tell when you feel bad as well. I like to have pizza with my friends, but I know when I've eaten stodgy pizza base, how it makes my stomach feel the next day. But I've only been able to learn that by moving away from it and then coming back. Yeah. So you sound like you're that high performing human. You're trying to do everything really well, and therefore you've got to be really engaged all of the time on what you're doing.
Yeah, that's the aspiration. You're right. There's times when you do lean a bit too far in one direction. But I think it was been a really interesting exercise moving from Australia to New York and being living downtown Manhattan. While I was there, we were growing the business 100% year on year. We had one child, had twin babies when we were there. We were growing cheer in all through Central and South America. And growing, highly rapidly, but also, so there's a lot of stresses. And it was interesting coming back from there to Australia, which is a very conscious decision. And mainly came to Perth, closer to the farms, but also closer to where he had some family. And it's been a really interesting exercise and just sort of changing my rhythms of work and timing and what I do and what I don't do. And it took a sort of a conscious decision, even sort of that physical change of location to do that, because it was hard to, even though you kind of know, either consciously or subconsciously, you're not doing everything as well as you should be, or something's compromised, it's really hard when you're in the process of doing it. You know, when I was in New York, it was just early mornings and late nights and work, and travel. And just, yeah, it took this change out of that to look back and go, hang on, that's just not a sustainable way of living. You need to balance this up. You need to, you know, work a bit different, live a bit differently. And that's, so it's been a really enlightening sort of process the last few years to go through that. Sometimes it takes a health issue for that to happen. So, you know, but that wasn't the case now. It's just a case of, you know, relocating.
What sort of issue did you have with your heart? Was it like an atrial fibrillation type thing?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, just virus. Then when I was overtraining, then created all these issues around it. But I was able to fix just by backing off the training, really. But you know what it's like when you're sort of hitting plateaus on times, and you think, you know, you've got two choices: you either back it off or you push harder to crack through that plateau. And as a young guy trying to get to the next point, you think, well, double down on the training, and that'll be the way to crack the plateau. It wasn't the best decision at the time.
Now you're a more sensible man with a family and a business, and a bit more aware of your own mortality, I guess, like the rest of us.
Taking a day off or a few days off training is a smarter decision. Yeah.
I think that in triathlon we get immersed in that subculture community where everybody's trying to perform well. And we measure ourselves against people in that small community. So you think, well, I only came 20th in my age group, or I came last in that, you know, I came last in that particular wave there. So I'm not very good. But actually, if you step out of that small niche and compare yourself against 100 randomly selected people from the streets of Perth, you're probably near the front of the queue, if not sort of at the front and way ahead of everybody else. And I think perhaps we all need to take a breath and get a sense of perspective occasionally on where it stands us as human beings, not just specific triathletes.
Yeah, it's been interesting being in it, and when you're right amongst it, it's and look, I haven't been at the level of professionalism that, you know, a lot of your listeners are at or been at, but I just know how much it dominates your thoughts about what you do, you know, in the morning, and get that ride in and get the swim in and get the run in, and how many have you done this week, and it basically drives your life, which makes you superbly fit, but it just does dominate, and it's particularly leading up to big events. So it's interesting after coming back out of that and then sort of looking from a little bit of distance and talking to families and friends that are still in it, and they kind of and letting them voice their sort of, you know, their concerns or anxieties or frustrations of being a partner of a really, you know, committed triathlete. It's a challenge to balance it up, and but you're right. I mean, if you take the cross-section of the community, the triathletes are this tiny percentage of the fittest of the fit. And, I mean, I think it's an amazing sport. I love it. But it is it certainly can be quite obsessive. And, you know, just even the gear and the bike you ride and, you know, the wheels and the you know, what gear you've got this week and what you've – it just becomes because every little bit's a one percenter. And you know, it just, you can never have the right stuff, can you?
No, and we've got Dave Brailsford, who was the, you know, the boss of British Cycling to thank for marginal gains. And a lot of people are focused on marginal gains when there's some very small gains to be had at the top of the tree, and you have to climb a long way and very precariously to go and find them. But quite often there's some huge, great gains hanging right in front of you. And nutrition is one of them. So if we bring that, but you know, triathletes are great for looking for the one percenters, as you say, but and like in business, you could probably look for one percenters, but there's probably some huge things that you could fix first that would give you a lot more gains. So let's bring this around and finish it off with nutrition and triathletes, because that's a perfect marketplace for you and for Cheer. They're most of them are engaged about what they're eating. Improving nutrition is perhaps one area where I think a lot of triathletes think they eat pretty well, but when you actually analyze it, they don't. but I know they're engaged. So here's an opportunity just to summarize, John. I'm a triathlete. I'm listening to this and I need five good reasons why I should think about including cheer in my diet on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. Over to you.
Okay. So if we're looking for a plant-based food solution, you want nutrient density. So you got the richest form of plant-based omega-3 fiber and protein in a tiny seed. You can put it with anything. You put it in a smoothie. You can put it in a juice. You can just put those little shots on your cereal or your yogurt. You can throw it in a salad. So nutrient-dense, easy to use. It's portable. It doesn't spoil, doesn't go off. You can keep a tub in the cupboard for, you know, for weeks. And, yeah, I think you can eat it knowing that you're eating highly sustainable, you know, traceably grown crop from a part of the world where people are really passionate about growing good crops and growing plant-based foods. So that might be more than five. But it also is a product that can go into so many places and you can combine it with a whole range of foods. So you can eat it on its own or eat it with a whole range of other foods. So that makes it really interesting. It makes it exciting to use and eat. And, you know, and I think further than that, if you've ever read Born to Run or any of the books that, you know, Cheer's involved in, there is some pretty strong anecdotal as well as some good clinical research to show that it can help your performance.
Yeah, you're right. I think that was more than five, but I'll let you off with those, John. Thank you very much. So, listeners, that was John Foss. John's the CEO. He's clearly a game changer himself, which is a nice way to end. I wish you much success, John, with this journey of yours, promoting the benefits and expanding the production of cheer and the distribution. And hopefully some of the listeners will get on this. I know we've got listeners in Australia. I know we've got listeners in America. And I know we've got listeners in most of our listeners in the UK. We've got a discount code that I'll put in the show notes and maybe I'll talk with some of your guys about seeing what we can do for our global listeners as well. But thanks very much for sharing that story. It's been really interesting to find out how you've gone from zero to almost world dominance in just a few years. So please keep up the good work.
Thanks, Simon. Pleasure to be on the show.
Yeah, great. Thanks, John. Take care. Right then, that's a wrap for this week. Thanks again for listening. As always, I appreciate that you have plenty of choice out there in podcast land, so it does mean an awful lot to me when you come back regularly. If you enjoyed the podcast, please could you hop onto iTunes or Podbean and leave a rating and a comment if you can. Apparently, it's really good for the ratings, although to be absolutely honest with you, I have no idea how they work these things out. If you like the way I roll and you find some synergy with my approach to life and sport, maybe be interested in joining my SWAT Inner Circle training group. If you are, please just email beth@thetriathloncoach.com for more details. You can also use that email address to ask for my special free gift, which I have for you, which are my top 25 tips on how to be a high performance human. Okay, that's all for this week. I'll be back next week with another great guest. So for now, enjoy the rest of your week.